took Claude Monet 3 years, from 1914 to 1917, to finish his Nymphaeas en fleurs, otherwise known as Blooming Water Lilies. It sounds strange, perhaps, but these serene paintings are actually emblems of global trade, of the circulation of goods, and of blindness. Blooming Water Lilies is a mesmerizing painting. You can see the green foliage of his garden in Giverny delicately interplaying with the surface of the water. Floating lily pads of blue and violet drift across a horizonless pond where light seems to dissolve into its depths. And these flowers have these alluring yellow stamens in their center. They hover within the abstraction as a pop of color. Monet had first seen these flowers at the Paris World's Fair in 1889. They were white in Europe right up until then. That was until a horticulturalist crossed native European varieties with tropical lilies. And so came the serene yellow that explodes from Monet's canvases. These perfect lilies, intentionally or not, speak to economy and power. Their soft impressions carry larger forces, and so it's not exactly an exaggeration to say that something of the wider world is folded into Monet's most serene pictures. That brings me to the work of Oscar Murillo, a contemporary artist whose practice spans painting, participatory projects, video, sound, and installation, makes work that tries to encompass the world in similar ways. Ideas and language slip across boundaries, they intermingle and circulate. And just like clusters of water lilies in Monet's pond, you will find a much wider world in the marks on Murillo's canvases. I cannot think of another artist working today whose practice is like weaving a connective tissue across time and space, as if it's a painting of a global landscape. My name is Kate Brown. I'm an editor and writer. And this is a podcast about how paintings can hold time, moving between two artists of very different times and spaces. The French Impressionist painter Claude Monet and the Colombian-born, London-based artist Oscar Murillo. This episode considers how color, and blue in particular, as well as marks, can carry more than their parts. It's about how color holds memory and how painting, good painting, resists easy resolution. Murillo has thought a lot about Monet.
I don't think that water lilies were even important for Monet. I think it was just a motif. The garden was a construction. I mean, gardens are constructed, but I think such was the radicality of his pursuit as an artist that he created a garden in order to paint. I think Monet, of course, as an artist and all the critical importance is undeniable.
Recently in an essay, he described Monet as iconic in the Warholian sense. He was known for painting an image obsessively, serially, over and over again, trying to capture it at different stages with different variations of light. Monet spoke in letters about looking for something instantaneous in his paintings, the way that light spreads over everything. At Decimansk and the Museum Barberini in Potsdam, just outside Berlin, a major grouping of Murillo's works has been on view this year alongside seminal paintings by Claude Monet, of which the Barberini holds 40. It's a world-class collection. The exhibition, Collective Osmosis, curated by Anna Schneider and Daniel Milnes of Decimansk, marks the first collaboration between these two institutions, which are sister venues, both financed by the Hasso Plattner Foundation. Crucially, for the first time ever, Monet's were moved from the Barberini over to Decimansk. And while it might seem at first like an unlikely pairing, Murillo has been engaging with Monet's practice for a while. The title, Collective Osmosis, says something about why. Osmosis connotes a substance moving from one side of a semipermeable membrane to another. A transference, in other words, and a seeking of equilibrium. As such, osmosis, for Murillo, is a metaphor for porousness and for exchange. Between these two painters, between their serial abstractions, their mark-making, their use of color. But Murillo also transforms the museum into a site of exchange. Between him and Monet, but also between people who come to the museum and can paint on a monumental work outside. Oscar and I were together at a recording studio in Berlin recently, discussing his works and his continuous interest in Monet.
For me, it's more a broader idea of an usurp, you know, like usurping Monet, like when he hijacked Monet, you know. And what I mean is Monet has critical mass, the masses in general, like universally speaking, around the world will know what, who Monet is. There is critical acclaim. There is, of course, beauty. The thing that then makes it kind of appealing to me was the fact that he was suffering from cataracts. And so, like, all this kind of mainstream critically acclaimed, you know, take, you know, the virtuosity, you know, take, you know, radicality in the context of his practice. And then, of course, the personal thing that just, like, this is the artist, was the fact that towards the end of his life, he was suffering from cataracts. And I thought, here is an entry point for me to antagonize beauty.
Though the art of Murillo and Monet are disparate in many ways, there's something approachable and universal about the themes they each explore. There are formalities, of course, that one can find between the paintings. An interest in meticulous craft, mark-making, and the impressions that emerge from that. There's also a sense of density. That the artists also don't sit together entirely harmoniously creates an electrifying tension. It's the gaps and the incongruence that actually makes things interesting. And much like Murillo's practice, there's no need to tidily resolve this. The show folds time and distance across several axes at once. There are the Monets, these incredible works more than 100 years old. And then there's a survey of more than a decade of Murillo's own practice. And then there are marks of an uncountable number of others whispering across this exhibition too. Murillo's practice includes collective paintings and social mappings and drawings called frequencies, which are collected from all over the world via participatory projects. This nonlinear approach to making work taps into something deeply human and continuous.
But if there's one person in this art world that understands the politics of institutions, it is this guy who sometimes comes across shy, you know, Oscar Murillo. He understands the politics.
That's Bonaventure So Bejeng Dikong, director of Berlin's Haus der Kultur in der Welt, who was most recently the curator of the 2025 Sao Paulo Biennial. Murillo was a part of this, showing a collective painting.
It is the dismantling of those structures. So if he invites 20-something people from his village in Colombia to come to the Tate and sing, three bands come together and he pieces them together and they're experimenting, you know. And I've been there. I've seen this happening a few years ago during the Venice Biennial and this exhibition he did. And, you know, we brought in people from Cameroon, from Ghana, from Colombia, and they all came together and they were making music and this holy grail of the visual art and slowly putting holes, making it porous. You understand? It's still there. We can see it, but it's also very transparent. And I think that's what I love about Oscar's work too, you know? He's concerned about something much larger than the too often simplistic, identitarian, simplistic structures we put into or sometimes we want to fit ourselves into. I think his antennae are there and he feels things. And if we wanted to do something about humanity, I think he's one of the artists of our time that has gotten an incredible understanding of this plurality, you know, was an incredible understanding, or at least is in the research to understand how we struggle to conjugate humanity, you know, from his own biography, but also the interest in connecting to other peoples in the world.
A century after Monet's death, the relevance and awareness and value of his work is unwavering. To this end, several Monets have moved across the city of Potsdam. It's hard to overemphasize the effort required to transport a work by Monet. In this historic loan, three works traveled across Potsdam from the Barberini to go on view at Das Minsk. To bring a Monet any distance is a highly involved process.
It doesn't matter whether they're traveling out of the country or whether only this 1 kilometer across the bridge, that there's the same kind of intensive process of care and of security and all the measurements you have to take in order to make that possible.
That was Anna Schneider, co-curator of the exhibition and director of Das Minsk.
And it was only like when we were already far in the process that I learned that out of the 3 paintings that are currently on view here at Das Minsk, 2 had never traveled since they're in the collection. So even in large exhibitions with important partners of the Museum Barberini, they were not allowed to travel because of what it takes. And it was only due to the kind of legal construction that we had that was possible. So in that sense, it was really like a unique opportunity for us. But of course, like when you're involved in this whole process, you also start thinking around like all the economy around transporting goods, and in that case, transporting very valuable goods. And that does have a resonance with Oscar Murillo's work, who has been thinking of like circulation in many ways, like in different forms, the circulation of objects and goods, but of course also of people. And now with Monet, also that's the circulation in terms of landscape and water and nature also kind of comes into the play. But I think there is definitely something behind the pleasure that we have looking at these beautiful masterpieces. But when you start working with them, like to see the whole operation behind displaying a work like that and moving a work like that becomes very kind of tangible and real.
Climate control specialist creates and roots plan down to the smallest detail. Key parts of Murillo's practice are totally antithetical to this. And as you move through Das Minsk, sound leaks between rooms. You can hear video playing footage from Murillo's collective painting session. The Barberini also features a monumental work by Murillo on view with a group of Monet paintings, meaning that at both museums, there are rooms that function like portals, folding the distance and perspectives and time onto themselves. Part of the strategy is to create a sense of permeability between spaces, and in particular, transcend the boundaries between the institution and the world outside. In the case of Das Minsk and the Barberini, it's about collapsing distances and playing with scale.
In the conversation I had with him, he said, every taxi driver would know Monet, you know, which is true. When you get to that level, you've broken all boundaries. Now, so what does it mean for a young artist from Colombia? And maybe some expectations are there for what he should be doing, right? You remember somebody in the audience asked that question, you know, about Monet's whiteness and so on and so forth. And Oscar's response was, hear my name and look at me. What does it say? It says, on the one hand, this is your canon, and we will make it porous. To me, it is the perfect notion of decanonization. It is not necessarily dismantling the canon, but making it porous. We can see through it. We understand it. We relate to it, because that is a part of human expression, right? You can stand in front of a Monet, and you get a chill. And it's irrelevant if you were born in South Africa or in Scandinavia. You get a chill. So that is what he relates to.
At Das Minsk and the Barberini, Murillo chose to have 2 different iterations of Monet's grain stacks sit apart from one another, but together in this show. At the time that Monet was making these was when France was rapidly changing. Industrialization was altering the landscape, and so to me, these are not simply pastoral views. These paintings by Monet speak to the logic of urban centers that are somewhere beyond the painting. Railways, seasonal labor, the economies of feeding cattle. Ortrud Westheider, director of the Barberini, describes how Monet would have a gardener carefully brush off the water lilies and lily pads in his Giverny pond, which would get soot and dust from passing train traffic. In Murillo's work, the folding of distance does a similar thing. Rural and far-off realities appear closer to us in urban centers where his works tend to be on view in institutions. The Houses of Parliament Sunset, dated from 1900 to 1903, is on view at Das Minsk. Monet's Parliament series depicts a view of the London Houses of Parliament on the Thames in many different lights. Painted at the turn of the century in the final years of Queen Victoria's reign, one can think of the British Empire and its colonialism being administered from this building. In that sense, as Murillo has put it, the work, quote, conveys a great darkness. Indeed, the building itself is rendered as a shadow by Monet. And that shadow, according to Murillo, quote, arises from Monet's painterly refinement, but it also carries a historical truth within it. That truth, in other words, is the fact of imperialism and industrialization detected in these scenes. Murillo continues, quote, the shadowiness of the Parliament is also a reflection of our contemporary society. The shadow falls on us too, on our social context and on how we relate to one another.
I'm not interested in like bringing politics with like capital letters into my work. With Bonaventure in Decus, their friend, and he was saying, well, you know, it's gotten so bad that we got to use poetry, you know. So that's kind of, you know, remarkable. It was really interesting we said that. And I kind of believe in that, you know, as a means to, again, you know, alluding to the title, Collective of Osmosis, as a means to like, you know, let's find common ground, you know, like where we can begin to kind of like ease into each other. I mean, for the longest time now, you know, we've been instrumentalized to bring out of the human being, you know, radical streams.
Here's an excerpt of Murillo reading a poem he wrote, which he shared in a recent talk with Ndikung. Hearing Murillo's words and considering his practice in general, one could think of it like mapping, but not in the Cartesian sense. This is mapping as network building, and Murillo has referred to it as social mapping in particular when speaking about his massive participatory drawing projects.
Speed of light, 600 miles per hour, the sea, geographies, terrain, labor, repetition, people, many, more public, more people, profound statements, buried, utterance of love, protest, an emoji, a sea of marks, condensed time, the harnessing of thoughts, energies, spirits, all manifestations in color, frantically, frenetically, awareness of places, time defaults thought into a stream of unconscious scores.
In 2024 at Tate Modern, Murillo created a work called Flooded Garden, a monumental participatory installation in the main turbine hall. All told, there were 500 square meters of raw canvas mounted on 5-meter-tall scaffolds. These were in a curved effect, reminiscent of Monet's water lilies installed on curved walls in the Musée de l'Orangerie in Paris just after his death. Murillo takes the immersiveness one step further. At Tate Modern, visitors painted messages, names, and small gestures that slowly layered back towards abstraction. In Potsdam, there's a similar work on view, a curved canvas standing just outside the museum. Like a natural landscape, it shifts each day as different visitors come and engage with its surface, doodling flowers, their names, or maybe just a zigzag pattern. Art, Murillo has said, is a communal project.
Even when the commission by the Tate at the Turbine Hall, that it was, you know, this very strong performative work using Monet as a vessel, one of the things that took place was that we made a grid, like a color chart almost, like we designed it, and the same color was supplied to an audience that would come to participate. So one color, let's say every 2 or 3 hours, so, you know, blue or, you know, darker blue or yellow or, so again, like kind of dissecting a Monet, you know, water lily painting, right? And you say, what color is in this painting? So you can identify certain colors. And we made a grid. And what people found really amazing was this kind of orchestration or like this uniformality. So that there was this idea that it was a collective. But of course, it wasn't a collective because there were thousands of people that just had nothing to do with one another. In fact, some hated each other because it became a platform of protest. You know, like a lot of people were saying certain things that were in disagreement. Obviously, then it became a conflict. But then it was all under the same color. But then it was just this landscape or this like scape, right? That was somehow choreographed. And that happened through this very, you know, simple but rigorous program of like supplying colors to, in almost like in a performative way.
In 1912, Monet was diagnosed with severe nuclear cataracts, which progressively tinted his vision yellow and dulled his perception of color. In 1925, he could see colors again that he had lost for more than a decade. These medical shifts in his vision caused his final paintings to become flooded with hypersaturated blue and violet tones. The temporary blindness that Monet suffered is something that Murillo has extrapolated on. Murillo takes this notion, calling it social cataracts, as a metaphor for society's social blindnesses. The layers in his abstract paintings are expressions of this idea. Take Surge, Social Cataracts, a new large-scale triptych on view at the Barberini. It almost seems like the rippling surface of water and references Monet. But it's much more complex than that. The title references both Monet's visual disability, but also the idea of a surge as an uncontrollable and sudden increase of force or power. This has both political and environmental undertones.
That, to me, was the interesting thing in relation to, like, how can I kind of, like, build a kind of metaphor around this condition to, you know, to speak of a complicated world now, you know, whereby I'm like infiltrating myself. When you like manage to get somewhere where you don't belong, you know, because of course the issue is that when you're antagonistic or when you're protesting and you're throwing stones, they'll shut the door immediately because they can see you coming. But when you like enter and you can like begin to kind of take apart the system from the inside, then it's a different thing. You know, it can be more effective. And I think Monet allows for that. Monet is somebody that has allowed for that kind of blindness, you know, like the idea of blindness, you know, the idea of not wanting to see or not being able to see, you know. So Monet is just a vessel for like a broader conversation.
Murillo's painting process involves standing over the work. He doesn't paint on easels. In that sense, his entire body is involved in the process, and the abstractions that come of it are like a kind of typography, with Murillo floating above, getting an aerial view. He works with a transfer technique that means he cannot always see exactly how the paint lands. It's a sort of blind carbon copy. Something that I think is so resonant in his work is this idea of surrender. So often we humans try to have dominion over things, be it the natural world, one another, but also creative ideas and our processes with them. In Murillo's work, I see something very refreshing. By creating limitations, he somehow finds freedom.
I think the word copy is complicated because it's not a singular. Like, it is a transfer, but it's not a copy. Each time the movement of the body, each time the mark is different. The process is the same, but it's not really a copy. So then what happens is, as you correctly described, then I'll put a blank sheet of paper, of canvas or paper, but let's stick to painting. So canvas with a metal rod, like the length of my body, with a somewhat pointed end. It can't be too pointy because it rips the canvas. I would just very physically download a lot of force and then just movement. And so the pressure achieved will leave a mark, no, on the inside. So then on one hand you have the positive mark, which is the new print and the movement in blue, red or black. And then, you know, sometimes I would, you know, almost like in a printing process, I'll do red first and then blue and then black, and then you know, you have this like doodle that was in different, you know, colors, but they were done separately. And then, you know, as you continue this process, of course the paints begins to dry, but also they start to run out. So then the positive mark becomes fainted in the process of doing so. And so that's how I got rid of this, like, of the anxiety of, you know, making it work. And, you know, there are kind of allusions to automatism because, you know, as you rightly said, I'm not really looking at the process, or like I can't really see the result. And this is something that I still do, that is fundamental to my artistic painting process. I needed to find, you know, a way that felt satisfying to me, but also that in the struggle of being a young, you know, artist, you know, that you could sustain it, that you could make it sustainable. Because of course, as you know, things are almost impossible now for young artists in terms of making ends meet, you know, in major cities around the world. So that was really a concern too. You know, how can I have a practice that I don't have to think too much about money? I wanted to inbuild all these kind of preoccupations from the beginning. That was important.
When I spoke to him, we talked about how he uses red, black, and blue in his drawings, working only with ballpoint pens.
Those three colors are still very, very dominant. And the, you know, you go around, I mean, I'm getting ready for a show in October. Yeah, I mean, those colors are still very much dominated. They dominate the palette. I think that's that kind of thinking about the you know communication, right? Like communication. I think the idea that, like, if everything was to, like, fall apart and collapse and I was left without the infrastructure that I have now, that I could still make my work.
A note on the sound we've been hearing throughout this podcast. It's a performance by Lamine Fofana that took place around Collective Osmosis, excerpts of which we are listening to. Blues Redux traces diasporic sounds in music. Fofana's got this layering that creates an immense kind of weight, a density of ideas and references that reminds me of Murillo's canvases. Fofana told me that he was thinking about Monet's desire to paint around objects, to paint the air around them and the light around them, and what it could mean for music. There are familiar sounds that you'll probably hear and tonalities, but they're made strange. Fofana, who's based in New York, creates musical landscapes that are textured and various, and they feel like they're of many worlds and temporalities. One can hear expressions of movement, migration, and alienation, even in bird calls that are somehow more than earthly. There's a sense of overlapping history and a networking of time and space. Maybe you could call it a sonic osmosis. There's a sense of equilibrium to the tracks, a coordination carefully managed by Fofana that washes the sounds together but never totally merges them, never lets them blend. Lamine Fofana's performance called Blues Redux, in part a meditation on blue, brings us to thinking about the color itself, something that we've been orbiting around a lot so far. The elusive and strange nature of the hue, which captured Monet and which captures Murillo and so many other artists across time. Art historian Evie Hatch speaks about how ancient Greeks did not separate blue and black into distinct color categories. They grouped them under the same word, describing a glossy, dark blue color that merges into black. And that's not the only ancient language that lacked a distinct word for blue. There's one particular work on view by Murillo at Das Mintz called Telegram that can perhaps serve as an interesting entry point to think about the color more deeply. Here's Anna Schneider reading off a poem that Murillo included on the frame.
Maybe some of you have already encountered his painting Telegram here up on the first floor. Here he quotes Marguerite Duras' The Lover on the frame. And I quote, "I can't really remember the days. The light of the sun blurred and annihilated all color. But the nights, I remember them. The blue was more distant than the sky, beyond all depth, covering the bounds of the world. The sky, for me, was the stretch of pure brilliance
crossing the blue, that cold coalescence beyond all color. The light fell from the sky in cataracts of pure transparency, in torrents of silence and immobility. The air was blue. You could hold it in your hand. Blue.
This poem brings together the ideas of cataracts and the enigma of blue. Blue itself behaves a little like Murillo's practice. Materials like ideas migrate, and pigments travel through hands and also histories. Here's Evie Hatch, the art historian I mentioned, describing the characteristics of blue.
The blue itself is a reflection on vastness and transcendence, I suppose. The transcendence of the world. And this is an idea that is echoed, or rather that echoes, Eve Klein's very famous quote about blue. In the mid-20th century, he said that blue has no dimensions. It is beyond dimensions, whereas the other colours are not. So here it's this idea that that blue is in the realm of the spiritual. And it's an idea that I think that we're all familiar with, which is the idea that there's something other about the colour blue, something beyond nature and something beyond the material world. I find a really kind of delightful tension in that. In my own work, which is focused around the materiality of pigments, I think with blue in particular, there's a tension between the material and the immaterial. And I think that idea of geography and human limits and the aspiration to kind of overcome those limits is really key to the stories of blue. I think blue sits in a really interesting space between the material and the immaterial, between heaven and earth. And the stories are very kind of mobile histories. They contain elements, I suppose, of osmosis, about how materials move from one place to another. Technologies are adopted and transformed, and associations can accumulate and shift. And a blue that begins as a physical substance can become a symbol, a memory, an atmosphere, or a spiritual idea. And what I think really interests me is that these movements are never one way. You know, matter becomes meaning and meaning becomes matter. And the material and the immaterial constantly bleed into one another.
It's no wonder, really, that this enigmatic color captivated Impressionists so much, especially as blue pigments became more readily available. And just as Monet's lilies unexpectedly carry the world within them, as I mentioned before, these blue pigments tell stories of circulation and of time.
What Monet would have used was actually quite modern in his time. It's a cobalt aluminate pigment, so it's a compound that contains cobalt and aluminium. While it was relatively new when he used it, cobalt itself has been used as a colorant for thousands and thousands of years. In 1982, a sponge diver off the coast of Turkey discovered the remains of a late Bronze Age merchant ship that sank in around 1300 BCE. And among its cargo were 138 ingots, so I suppose kind of pellets, of cobalt blue glass. And analysis suggests that these blue ingots were manufactured in Egypt before being loaded onto a ship traveling through the Eastern Mediterranean trade networks, probably towards the Aegean Sea. And if they had made it to their destination, they probably would have been melted and worked into finished glass objects. But I think what's even more exciting is not just how we can trace materials geographically, but also across time. So here we're jumping forward maybe around 2,000 years. When Abbot Suger talked about the stained glass windows that he was incorporating into his scheme, he talks about something that he calls materia sapphiorum. And what he's doing there is evoking the blue gemstones of the heavenly Jerusalem. So this blue stained glass, which you see across different examples of medieval stained glass, is a material that's capable of elevating the mind towards heaven. Researchers have suggested that certain medieval blue glasses, or cobalt blue glasses, may have been made, at least in part, from recycled Roman or Byzantine cobalt blue tesserae. So here we have a history that, you know, a piece of blue glass that might move from an Egyptian workshop to a ship's cargo hold, become part of a Roman mosaic, and then be broken up centuries later. melted down in a medieval glasshouse and finally end up filtering light inside a Gothic cathedral. So there is this circulation of blue, of recycled cobalt blue, a movement across time and space. Another 500 or so years later, Claude Monet would use modern cobalt blue, which is chemically related to these ancient blue glasses, in his paintings.
Cobalt is present in a lot of Murillo's work, as is ultramarine, a color that was hugely popular among the Impressionists and Monet. At Das Minsk, that monumental outside painting has a logic that includes blue. On its chart, there's cobalt blue, ultramarine blue, and other blues on rotation, cycled throughout a tight schedule. It's a similar approach that Murillo took with Flooded Garden at the Tate. Some moments are for pink, and there's orange days, but blue dominates. And you can see this balance in Murillo's work Surge, Social Cataracts, which is dominated with blue. Remember that works are made on the studio floor with that aerial view. And yet in Surge, there's an intense feeling of being close to a surface of something. Perhaps that's because of the density of blue oil sticks Murillo uses, the intensity of the color. Since 2013, Murillo has been creating frequencies, canvases attached to school desks worldwide. Students between the ages of 10 and 16 are invited to draw, write, and doodle on them. And they're collected over several months, from Ghana, Lebanon, Singapore. Effectively, it becomes a massive encyclopedia of the global human experience. Perhaps this is a way to beat back at social cataracts, at the conditions of a world that, frankly, cannot see clearly. The accumulated marks of thousands of young people still insisting on being visible. When these frequencies are installed, there are clear differences between the places. There's dust and patinas from different parts of the world, different pens and forms of expression from places that may be stricter or more rule-bound. But there are a lot of overlaps, truly universal doodles and messages. There are also problematic things, but Murillo insists that they need to be there as an honest, unfiltered expression of the world.
As I've written about in the past, it seemed to me like a seismograph. And I thought it was a genus of an idea, you know, as simple as that, you know, just record what the kids are, a kind of transmitting, transcribing from their subconscious onto canvas. And the title, Frequencies, was in itself very enigmatic. You know, it was like, yeah, this is it. You know, he is, you know, capturing these frequencies. So if you were going to find something, you know, from one's cliched understanding of a certain geography, one would definitely not find it. But what is very interesting is there are certain patterns that repeat themselves in those different places because kids are just kids, no matter where they are. And it is not universal, it is pluriversal. So there are things that might be specific to certain geographies in terms of, say, a script, a writing system, right? But a drawing is a drawing. A square in India is a square in Brazil. So there might be nuances. There might be slight tints, accents to what is put on paper. But there are commonalities. So you wouldn't find, you know, say, okay, because this is in, you know, Kenya, then it would have to be like that. No. That's the brilliance of the work, right? It's like tuning a radio and you drop in a certain place and you hear the same story or similar story. Because our concerns as humans are basically very similar.
Murillo's series Disrupted Frequencies renegotiates time and space between these countries by stitching the individual canvases from his Frequencies series together. That means that canvases from Colombia, Japan, the UK, or Egypt may be joined. And on these new, larger, stitched-together canvases, Murillo paints his abstractions, that dominant palette of blues and blacks. Ndikong has described it as a process of mapping, but also, crucially, as a negation of the map. Here's an excerpt of Ndikong reading a poem titled Maps by Indigenous Canadian poet Lee Maracle. Ndikong chose to read this poem in connection to Murillo's work during a conversation the two had at Das Minsk.
Maps are orders marching men to old places already seen. Maps conjure memories of spoil, of plunder, and innocence. Maps are journeys to illusions no one has learned from. Maps are critical revisits with visions, vistas, and never-before-seen repeats. Maps direct intentions, call attention, and direct us to previous being. Maps scatter reflection, leading us to delude our well-being. Maps flatten surfaces, pictograph time, distance.
But again, we find the central tension in Murillo's work, mark-making as a communication that resists conclusion, resists becoming didactic. Try to gather everything that moves through frequencies into something smooth and conclusive, and you'll fail. In that refusal to settle, we find something much closer to the human experience than certain takeaways could ever offer. It's a true sense of complexity. Letting things bleed through, whether it's pigment, geography, or generations, is part of Murillo's wager. Making institutions porous is another way of letting light in. And letting that light in is a way to push back against social blindness, whether that's via collective acts of making or creating space for other ways of seeing, or whether it's by bringing titans of art history into conversation with a different time logic or another world than to which they normally belong. And blue, for that matter, carries a similar charge. It's everywhere above our heads, the world over, shared and seemingly endless and perpetual. And yet it is elusive in nature, the object of so much poetry, tragedy, and melancholia. Blue's definitive form eludes us too, just the moment we try to hold it.
But I think, you know, like this whole engagement to kind of like ground it back down, you know, started with, like I said, like with, you know, a very simple like desire to draw. And I think for me, at the core of it lied, you know, almost like, refuge, but also was kind of therapy. I mean, I say, and this is not like, I'm not being like sensationalist, but, you know, I think art, you know, like saved my life because of where I come from. You know, in Colombia, I could have quite easily had been dead already, you know, like by the violence that young people are groomed in. I mean, quite literally, art was this kind of savior. It's this universe that is infinite. I mean, quite literally like a water well. And I guess in this like very profound time of crisis, I think of art as a means that everybody can be part of in a very simple way.
This podcast was recorded on the occasion of the symposium Blue, a conversation on collective osmosis, as part of the exhibition Oscar Murillo Collective Osmosis, which ran from March through August 2026 at Das Minsk Kunsthaus in Potsdam, including works by Claude Monet from the Hasso Plattner Collection. The exhibition curators were Anna Schneider and Daniel Mills. This podcast was written, edited, and hosted by me, Kate Brown. It was produced by ACB Stories. Podcast guests and excerpts were heard from Oscar Murillo, Bonaventure Sobejeng Dikung, Anna Schneider, and Evie Hatch. The music was provided by Lamin Fofana.